You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to WPS1 Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center at www.wps1.org. You might also be listening in San Francisco to KPOO 89.5 FM, and possibly at the San Francisco Arts Commission website as well, which is www.sfacgallery.org, and obviously at frankprattle.com. Today, two amazing guests, two guests that are going to blow you out of the water, that are going to lay you down in the middle of the street and run over you with a tractor. I have Julian Myers, who's an art historian, writer, and professor here in San Francisco. Hi, Julian.
Hello.
And Dominic Wilsden, who's the curator of education and public programs at SF MoMA.
Hello.
Hi. Why don't you guys start out just by giving a kind of brief introduction? Tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
I'm Julian Myers. I'm an assistant professor at California College of the Arts, and I've also taught in the last few years at UC Davis, UC Santa Cruz, and the San Francisco Art Institute. I'm also a writer. I've published in After All, October, Documents, and Freeze, among other magazines. I write on earthworks and the politics of American space in the 1960s and 70s, and on the promise and disappointments of consumer culture, among other stuff.
Okay, I've been in San Francisco 2 years, SF MoMA is a curator of education and public programs. I also teach at the San Francisco Art Institute and at CCA. Before that, I was in London as curator of public programs at Tate Modern and as a senior tutor in critical theory at the Royal College of Art, where I actually had a job that's equivalent to Julian's job here at CCA on the curatorial studies program there. So
wheels within wheels. Yeah. Is this a coincidence? I don't think so. So under the larger umbrella of conversation for these recent group of conversations has been public versus private. And one of the directions that I was kind of hoping to start off here, and we can go whichever way we want to meander, is the idea of adult education. And you both work in the fields of education. Obviously, Dominic, you know, you're in charge of that at SF MoMA, and Julian, you being a professor and also writing for the public. How have you guys seen adult education, and in specifically art education, changing over the past, I don't know, 20 or so years?
Well, I mean, it's my main knowledge and understanding of this comes from the UK. Before I worked in museums or in the in modern and contemporary art at all, I was a philosophy professor in adult continuing education, both at Birkbeck College at the University of London and at the Open University. And I mean, those two institutions in Britain are, you know, part of a, I think, a, you know, fantastic tradition in that country of continuing education for adults. It goes back to, you know, the workers' education authorities in the early, mid 20th century. And continuing education in Britain has been a context in which actually very, a lot of progressive thought has been pioneered and worked through, including early developments in cultural studies. And it's particularly, you know, in a history of education in Britain, where which was very elitist, on a class-based, system, it's really offered an opportunity to enable, at its best, a kind of a critical relationship to the culture to be possible for publics that aren't otherwise going to find that. I guess my hope is, that the sphere of contemporary art and the context of art institutions can be a stage for further developments in that tradition, and that might be possible in this country too, where I'm sure there's an equivalent tradition. It's a hope. I don't see it realized very often, but I'm sticking with it.
Julian, yourself?
You know, I'm hesitant to talk about this from anything other than my own position, because it's something that education isn't something I was trained in or necessarily one of my main goals. But, you know, just to say something about my own kind of perspective or history within this subject. On the one hand, my history is that I spent time in graduate school at UC Berkeley studying art history and teaching students there, which is, you know, at times was very frustrating, you know, watching students come in and sort of education factory, move through and sort of production of knowledge and then, you know, forget it as soon as they left the classroom. You know, one of the ways that knowledge is kind of configured in that circumstance is that is specifically around class and is around the lines of class and is conceived around notions of the enclosure, limitation of knowledge, and the handing down of specific forms of disciplinary knowledge in incredibly rigid and you know, in traditional, fairly traditional ways that, you know, by and large haven't really been affected by any sort of shifts in the last 20 or 30 years. On the other hand, it was through my involvement in kind of DIY or punk or zine culture, where the entire politic around education was around self-organization, communication in within sort of subcultural communities. You know, really privileging forms of self-organization and learning. And so, in my teaching, I have to negotiate constantly between those two poles. In some way, the kind of very traditional form of graduate education on the one hand, and the sort of interest in autonomy and self-organization on the other.
Which do you think that you tend to lean more towards, and, you know, Dominic, yourself as well?
Between
kind of a self-informed, you know, as Julian was saying, DIY form of knowledge, where people are out in the streets actively pursuing what they, you know, think is interesting versus, you know, an academic approach. I mean, both of you being PhDs, no?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if this is just this is the kind of thing that comes down to just the kind of person you are, but I guess I'm a fairly institutional kind of person. And I still have, it may just be I don't have the sensibility or the will or the talent or the creativity or whatever to find new paths to new ends, educational ends, new kinds of publics, that kind of thing. But, you know, being unable to do that, I do still believe in the possibility of institutions. I think that, you know, the institutions, medium-sized, large institutions, you know, there's terrific power and resources there, and it's possible not to change those places wholly, but to redirect some of that possibility to different ends. And I think there are things that can be done there, and too often those kinds of platforms are written off. So that just ends up being where I work, and I kind of try and do what I can do in that context.
For my part, this place is still a process of negotiation for me, just how I'm going to be a teacher, and I'm not sure I'm ever going to really resolve this particular dialectic in my own sort of experience in education. But, you know, for me, in the early moments of my teaching, it was I really did try to make it to center on forms of kind of self-learning or self-teaching or autonomy, and took the role of took a really different role than I take now. Now it became after those classes, those first classes were absolute disasters. You know, which
tell me, I want to hear.
Well, you know, I think I might have come off as like withholding information somehow. That somehow I knew the answer, but I was waiting for them to arrive at it on their own.
Right.
You know, it's a position. It's a specific pedagogical choice to focus, to allow students to arrive at their own conclusions and to allow them to control their own discourse. But it's often perceived as you're not really handing over the knowledges that you have. Yeah. You're not you're perceived as in a position of withholding sometimes.
That kind of gets exaggerated with, you know, when you have the high fees that people are paying to have this. It's like the knowledge and understanding is something they're buying, and you should hand it over. Because it's being paid for.
Yeah, I think that you really are negotiating between, I mean, an essentially economic reality, and one that when the expectations put on you are as an instructor or professor are dictated by relatively traditional expectations of what education is for and what it aims to accomplish. I mean, people do want the sets of knowledges that will allow them to speak in a particular disciplinary way. So I had to do some reconceptualizing, some very serious reconceptualizing after my first year or two of teaching. And I began to think a little bit more of teaching as a way of handing over particular tools that were useful in various circumstances. And this could include, you know, techniques, methodologies of primary engagement or primary research, close observation of artworks or images, forms of articulation, ways of putting oneself forward into the world, and critical concepts. I'm not quite sure that that's much different than the traditional form of education. But you know, this was sort of how I negotiated this problem, handing over tools so that someone can use them themselves, and you know, eventually expecting more and more of them, more and more independence, more and more autonomy, more and more creativity.
Do you think there's anything in this? Are you talking about there, at least to some extent, putting emphasis on a direct relationship to artworks? You know, kind of a response to that analysis of artworks. Do you think there's something particular about education in contemporary art? You know, possibly the way in which, you know, judgment and understanding are wrapped up together. That there's a kind of there's. I mean, this would be a part, maybe slightly idealistic way of approaching it, but it's, you know, one might think that there's a kind of an opportunity there that doesn't exist in say in the social sciences or in the hard sciences or something like that. Mm-hmm. That there's a, you know, a student has to make a judgment about something before knowledge, a knowledge process is sort of embarked upon.
Well, you know, art history, which is the forum, which is the discipline in which I'm trained, was founded in the moment of the Enlightenment as a discourse on judgment and on value. Mm. It seems that, I think it's still the case. People still do have, people can see an artwork and have a gut reaction to it. The problem isn't that they have an opinion, it's that they can't articulate why. And thinking about where these sorts of systems of judgment come from and why they're in place and what effects they have, I mean, that can be actually quite powerful.
I mean, so to bring it back to kind of an earlier comment that you made, is the division between teaching styles. Which have you found in both of your own experience to be the superior teaching style as far as, you know, teachers who taught you? You know, who are some of your favorites, and what methods did they employ, and do you try to, you know, use those as well to mimic that?
See, I didn't really. I started off studying, you know, art and art history, you know, studio practice and art history at the same, you know, in conjunction, and I didn't really know how to do art history. I really didn't know what a good art history essay was, or why anyone would want to write one. And I think that the thing that started to make sense to me was an understanding of starting to read and understand the new art history that came out of the late 1970s, where at its best the analysis of art was a way of analyzing particular social forms. That artworks became, if you like, kind of emblems of how society was organized in different places at different times, and it was and they were opportunities for you to actually feel some way about that, right, to feel some way about it, and then understand something about it on the basis of your feeling. And once artworks could be seen as kind of portals onto something which seemed of more general meaning and significance, I felt I could see the point of writing and thinking about artworks within an art historical frame.
Right.
When you say the new art history in the late 1970s, what are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of, if there's a book, it's probably T.J. Clark's Painting a Modern Life. or you know, the Manet and certain impressionists in the, particularly in the 1860s. So it's that, I guess. And then later on, well, not so much later on, I think Thomas Crowe's book, Painters in Public Life in 18th Century France, where the salon exhibitions at the Louvre in the mid-18th century, which are essentially the first ever public contemporary art exhibitions, become an arena in which Crowe is able to explore sort of social dynamics on effectively on the eve of the, you know, the Democratic Revolution, the French Revolution, and look at how culture was implicated in that.
What an incredible book that is.
Yeah.
My version, can you restate the question so I'm sure what I'm answering?
Just in general, but you know, take it whatever way you want, is we had talked about different methods of teaching, some being, you know, kind of a carrot on a stick, and the other being, you know, the banquet laid at your feet, and which teachers you've had that really inspired you, and which teaching methods do you mimic that way?
Well, you know, I've worked with people who've been very inspiring to me, and they've all taught in a way that was in this relatively traditional mode. Those people being Hal Foster and Susan Butt Morse at Cornell in the early 1990s. Though what they did in those moments was quite a mystery to me. It was absolutely mystifying. You know, I was a kid from the country, grew up in a very poor region. There's no sorts of conversation or discussion like this. Where I was from, and it just blew me away. And it took me, you know, a decade to really figure out how the hell they did what they did, where their ideas were coming from, and with what basis. When I moved here, I came here specifically to work with T.J. Clark or Tim Clark and Ann Wagner in art history at UC Berkeley, and that was the point at which these methodologies. Specific ways of interacting with artworks became much more clear to me. You know, as I said, it's a constant process of negotiation, trying to figure out whether those modes are themselves now sort of artifacts of history, whether what they have to do with the art of the present, specifically post-disciplinary or interdisciplinary practices or post-studio practices, or what they have to tell us, what close looking has to tell us about a form of practice. I'm not quite sure, and you know, at the same time as I'm interested in art from previous moments, I'm particularly interested in thinking about art from the present. But you know, the other side of that question is that I'm an independent-minded person, and I like to learn things on my own. And you know, that's not necessarily always coming from conversations, though often it is drunken conversations late at night somewhere, bar somewhere. Often it's sitting somewhere and reading a book, spending 2 days reading, you know, and coming to my own sort of reckoning with whatever material I've been handed.
Another kind of direction I would like to take the questioning is the idea of specifically physical context for learning and how that has, you know, been not only under fire, but definitely revisualized.
The physical context
for learning, recently, and how one goes about learning at a university, such as, you know, where you teach, Julian, or you know, where you teach as well, Dominic, versus how one learns outside of that, you know, we could say white cube, you know, fairly, but also, you know, your chalkboard environment, and what thoughts you have on that. And in specific to you, though, Dominic, you are kind of pioneering a program at the SF MoMA right now, possibly, you know, I hate to let the cat out of the bag, that would be a kind of school located at MoMA, and your ideas for that.
Well, there's, the backstory to this, and this is really, you know, a little bit of looking into the future, this project, if it happens at all, but the I guess the backstory to it is a tendency that is, I think, at least a decade old, which is to do with the insertion of various discursive processes into the space of art. I mean, I think of Documenta 10 as being a little bit of a a milestone for this exhibition in 97, which put so much emphasis on talks, at least as much as on exhibitions. And doubtless that wasn't the first occasion for that, but it was a particular statement. And in different ways, it's been increasingly the case, and certainly in the, 8 years that I've been working in art institutions, that discussion, discourse, and learning as an aspect of that have been more and more central, and you know, even to the point in which they're actually integral to exhibition concepts a lot of the time. And I think there's, you know, there's a big question of about what's going on there. On one hand, there's, I think, this is a response to a need that for one reason or another art institutions have to establish themselves as live venues. That, you know, once upon a time, museum just, it just existed, you went or you didn't, and that was it.
It was
a big building with some objects in it. And you know, more and more you work in museums and there's always discussions and meetings around animating the museum.
Right.
You know, and generation ago, thing didn't need animating. It was just there. So, and there were doubtless kind of issues to do with, you know, audience development and other economic factors that are behind that. But you know, for better or for worse, I think there's an opportunity there, and it's clear that for me, anyway, clear to me that art institutions remain specific, you know, very particular kinds of public space amongst all the different kinds of public space that are available in a city or in any kind of context. They continue to have interesting potentialities and possibilities as stages to make on which to make an educational contribution to public life. And I guess, yeah, at the moment I'm really, and this is kind of just why I'm interested in doing what I'm doing, is trying to work out what structures and what strategies might effectively kind of release the educational and social value, such as it might be, that these stages offer in a city like this one.
Julian,
can I ask you a question,
sure.
Dom? What do you picture when you say public life?
I think there's I've taught at least a couple of times the history of the concept of the public, going back to the 18th century, and it's there's a whole tradition which, you know, we can go through another time maybe, but there's a, you know, it's the concept of the public has a really special place in the history of democracy. You know, it's the question of what kinds of gathering can make possible the kinds of interaction that sustain a democratic culture. Democratic culture being something that you need to complement a democratic electoral system, right? It turns out this is at least the standard theory of it, that the concept of the public sphere at the beginning of modern times was originally a cultural thing. It began with the availability of novels and magazines about novels and coffee houses to go and talk about novels. And then in visual arts, you know, situations like the Paris Salon that we spoke about, and so I guess the persisting claim is that there might be some political point in creating opportunities for people to critically engage with cultural practice with each other, what today would that be like, and what kinds of situations can one create in which you can test out what the possibilities still are there?
And do you think in the present that there are problems with the way that that political discourse and cultural discourse are sometimes so radically separated, especially in the context of governmental power? I mean, does this pose particular problems for the kind of public life that you're talking about?
How would you say separate? Do you mean there's people are not looking to films and novels and things for as sort of exemplars of civic virtue?
Well, I mean, I think that many people are. I think that, but what I was thinking about was the way that sort of governmental power imagines those two issues, which is in a way that's almost absolutely completely separate. There are cultural institutions on the one hand, and there are, and it almost doesn't matter what they contain, what they have in them, and then political institutions on the other, where power is actually meted out. And
yeah,
you know, I mean we are here across from City Hall,
right? We're in a strange place here because we're in a civic
in the intersection of both right now.
Yeah. We're in an art space that's part of the sort of civic infrastructure of the city. I mean, this is I guess, you know, one way of thinking about this is there's a big kind of European American divide here. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to work in a museum that was more than 50% funded by the state, and now I don't. And the relationship between a substantially private museum like the one that I work for here and civic life is completely different. And it can exist and it can be made, but it's going to be made on a different basis. There's an interesting episode. There was a piece in an article I read about Mark Wallinger's piece, State Britain. I think it was called, that was, this was a work of art that was a kind of sculpt, a 3D facsimile of a protest that had been a one-man protest that had been conducted for years, this protest against the war in Iraq, outside the Houses of Parliament in Britain. There's this one guy who'd built this whole assemblage of protest signs and other things, and Wallinger had recreated perfectly this piece and put it on an exhibition in Tate Britain. And one of the I think it was a piece by Yves Alain Boire, actually, in Art Forum that I read. And one of the things that was interesting about it was the way he posed the question of why this protest against the government was okay to show in this government art institution, but not in the street, because actually only recently this thing had been taken down, this guy had been sent on his way. And the question that Bois was, I guess, you know, pushing towards was one about whether state-funded art institutions actually permit a kind of exhibition that is not permissible in public space, but sort of neutralize it at the same time. But I mean, that's just a specific case, but you know, the whole relationship between the state and culture is quite different. You go to Germany or France and it's different again. I mean, the entire French art infrastructure is a civil service infrastructure.
What?
So maybe I can return to your original question about physical context.
Sure.
So I teach in a private art college, which has
California College of the Arts.
California College of the Arts, which has really specific spatial politic, I think.
Just to give for the listeners, it's in an old Greyhound terminal that's it's giant. It's like an airplane hangar, no?
That's the size
of it, but although it was made for buses.
And then the space inside is carved up into smaller spaces, and it has the first impression that it puts off is an almost utopian idea. It seems like something that the constructivists would have wanted to put together for their schools of new radical avant-garde art. But you know, what I started thinking about was this idea of the ongoing practice of putting curators in positions of administrative power in art schools. Larry Rinder at California College of the Arts, and Oquien Wazer as dean at San Francisco Art Institute, and this idea that, which was put forward by Jordan Cantor in Art Forum, that this might allow for the schools to become spaces that were spaces of experimentation, that they may become not spaces of the transmission of disciplinary knowledge, but also, or alongside the space being spaces for the transmission of disciplinary knowledge, they might also take on forms of radical politics. They might become forms for much more experimentation. And you know, on the one hand, this is a purely conceptual idea. This is there's on the one hand this kind of conceptual or theatrical idea of these spaces as open, experimental. You know, I think it's an and on the other, there's this idea of of these art schools as deeply kind of enclosed or closed off from local communities or from you know, the differing relationships between forms between the students and the staff of the institution. So in ways that it's there are powerful inclusions and exclusions in that circumstance. You know, which contribute in different ways to the educational, the practice of education. You know, it's a powerful thing to be part of a group, part of a cell, a discursive cell where one is kind of excluded or from the world at large, at least conceptually or theatrically. You know, I always do this funny thing with my classes, and I don't. It's kind of like a behavioral tick. But whenever I go into a classroom, I always rearrange the chairs. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's really a kind of nervous habit for me. But I, you know, in some way, I think about it as creating through arranging the space according to, for us as constructing a sort of enclosure within which we can experiment with our thoughts quite safely.
One question that I have, and this relates directly to, you know, both of you guys and what you've been talking about, is the idea of the art institution becoming where the public is now looking for new art to come out of. I mean, to take, for example, California College of the Arts, hiring Jens Hoffman and having, you know, shows such as Paul McCarthy, you know, curating a show, and, you know, regardless of one way or the other, what you think about the show, like, that's, you know, a fairly large affair going on, and not necessarily always looking towards museums now is where the art is happening, and what your guys' feelings are on that changing role.
Well, that rather appeals to me, actually, even, and I really like the idea of, I mean, you know, it's a version of a older idea of the, you know, the university art gallery, you know, this sort of the place of exhibition that's the auxiliary of the place of learning and study, but you know, recast in a different way, and particularly to do with contemporary art. I think that you know, makes these institutions both of education and of presentation. To my mainly indirect experience, it kind of raises as many questions as it sort of answers. And it's often the case that the relationship between the gallery space and the educational institution is tricky, and often the relationship whatever was hoped to realize isn't quite realized, or at least it's an ongoing process. And I'm, you know, even when you look at I think fantastic combinations of this like UCLA and the Hammer Museum, it's you know, I talked to kind of colleagues down there, and it's surprising that the university doesn't use those spaces more, or that what happens there isn't part of the educational experience more. But I think it's a terrific model, and it's something that people, you know, should persist with. And I mean, yeah, I'd like to do it if the opportunity arose. I think it's a great setup.
Julian, yourself?
I can't remember the question, but I have a question for Tom.
Okay.
I'm a terrible interview subject.
I have that way of making people forget what's happened.
I forgot where I was. So I was curious to know what you thought. You know, maybe this follows on from what you just said. I was curious about this relationship. The idea of the museum as a place of kind of absolute power, you know, or power. Well, I know from within it looks a little different, but you know, the reality of a museum being something a little bit different, something the museums are institutions of art as sort of hemmed in by different interests, suspended in some way, institutions of art being suspended in some way between economic exigencies and a skeptical public, in this sort of concept, and the idea that the idea I've heard advanced kind of in conversation that that it's in the private or market that it's in the space of the art market and in privatized art galleries where autonomous practice can actually happen, that the museum is actually quite has a lot of problems investing in true forms of autonomy. And that the market that the market ends up being a much freer space for art practice.
Okay, I mean, I don't really have I don't really hope a lot for from museums in terms of staging very new art practice. I think museums are always late, right, and slow, and that's the way it should be. You know, everyone, the whole infrastructure of the art world has its different scales of activity and different types of organization, and you know, everybody has to play their allotted role.
Right.
And I think it's important that museums should try and as all do have strands of, you know, new work strands or, you know, project spaces and things like that. But I think that and this is why I think it's interesting for me to be, you know, on the education side, because it's museums come to the topic when the dust has settled a little bit.
Right.
Even in terms of relatively new art practice, and I think that it's the important thing for me. And you know, I have friends and colleagues that work in other parts of the art world that don't know why I work in the kind of institution that I do because of those kinds of factors. And for me, ultimately, what's at stake here is that there need to be institutions that can make a bridge between a public that is very committed to contemporary art and a public that isn't so. I think that contemporary art has, and modern art has, a contribution to make to the larger cultural discourse, and that cultural discourse is a contribution to make to our civic life. And if there aren't large scale, slow moving, etc., institutions to do that, then it's going to be left to novels and the movies to do that. And I see it as, you know, part of my job to try and make a case for contemporary art in those, you know, larger processes of life amongst, you know, with different kinds of public who aren't deeply committed to contemporary art, and there's no reason why they should be.
One of the things I find particularly interesting is that emphasis from at least the museums that I've seen around, you know, the United States and in the world as well, that emphasis on the educational program is really gaining, whereas, you know, typical interest in your painting and sculpture departments tends to be waning a bit as far as contemporary life and you know, what people are actually interested in seeing, especially from a contemporary view, that that the idea of staging social projects and things like that tends to be on the more cutting edge than, you know, your latest rerun of Picasso or Matisse. You know, what are your feelings?
I don't know. Have you been to a Picasso or Matisse exhibition lately? I mean, they're not lacking for audiences, as far as I can tell. You know, there does still exist a deep sort of bourgeois investment in that moment in painting, and that moment in culture. I don't think that interest, that sort of cathexis upon that moment in painting, has necessarily lost its allure. I think it's maybe the last, like, maybe it's sort of post-1960s art where the audiences are maybe less pronounced.
Well,
even that's in particular situations.
For example, I was traveling this last summer in Lithuania, in Vilnius, Lithuania. They're opening up a Fluxus Museum entirely based on the principles of Fluxus, running a museum on the idea of Fluxus, not just like having exhibits about it, but shifting office furniture, shifting managerial positions, everything. And I mean, recontextualizing ideas of museums like that becoming more important to people than simply going to see, you know, another Van Gogh, I think is the direction that, you know, art is going, that art appreciators are going in that way.
I think that's that may be a direction that the public committed to one form of contemporary art might be going. But yeah, I mean, I it seems to me that in actuality the audience for art is still fairly enormous. I don't necessarily see there being a move towards a greater interest in Joseph Beuys or Fluxus style, or even Marcel Brotherr's rearrangements of museum situations. I don't see there being a kind of boom in that sort of practice or in an audience for that practice. It does seem to me that there is a sort of way in which museums are forced in the present to invest in different ways and that in forms of practice like that because of particular sections of their constituency sort of looking for a museum that's sort of moving faster or is more self-reflexive and self-critical. But I'm not quite sure that those are directives from a real public as much as an imagined one.
I think there might be a US-Europe division here a little bit to do with the different political economy that's at work in each case. And you know, again, I have still quite limited experience in this country, but it seems slightly more. The focus of museums seems slightly more on material images and objects. Because of the relationship with the market and with collectors, and that's a powerful nexus and a powerful setup that the museums have to work with and within, and to some extent in Europe, because the state is setting up a remit for museums to be representative of the culture that they lay claim to. That there may be more possibility for exhibiting or including the kinds of practice that you're talking about, but with that situation in Europe, or certainly in Britain, there is this kind of links in with part of your question, I think, a real drive towards trying to maximize the social value of what museums do. I think that it seems pretty clear now at this distance that. The election of the Labour government in 97, at that point there was some kind of agreement between the Department of Culture and the Treasury that the Department of Culture would continue to be funded or would be well funded if its cultural policy could be tied to social policy in some way, and the dynamics and the debates in the British art world, I'm not sure the situation now so much, but certainly 97 through to 5 years ago, possibly, were a lot to do with the what was gained and what was lost in making that agreement.
Right. There was, I mean, a specific instance. I mean, just to highlight the differences. I mean, between the UK and the United States, I was listening to the director of the Tate Modern speak, and he was talking about one of the fundraising techniques that the Tate has or had for a while was offering collectors a dinner with Tony Blair. To come and show up at the house or restaurant wherever and chit chat about art and the like and the idea of that concept being completely untranslatable in the United States. The idea that George Bush would show up.
Okay.
There are paintings George Bush likes. They're just all of cowboys.
Yeah. I mean, okay, maybe not the president, but actually I think that's kind of an American method. You know, it's kind of I think that there are individual donors in the museum world, in the art world. I mean, one of the things that they're interested in is in a way augmenting their lives with a different kind of experience. And it's mainly meeting artists, politicians, don't know. But it's that idea of access to somebody or other,
right.
Does have a monetary value in the art world here.
True. Well, I mean, that's kind of a depressing note to leave it on, but unfortunately, I think that
what
we're
happened
out
to
of
education?
Time.
You know,
it all comes back to money. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. You're listening at WPS1 Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate, at www.wps1.org or KPOO 89.5, Poor People's Radio here in San Francisco. You might also be listening to San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery Radio website, which would be www.sfacgallery.org, and of course, frankprattle.com. My special guest today, tearing it up, leaving you feeling sore, Julian Myers, art historian, writer, and professor. Thank you so much, Julian.
Thank you.
And Dominic Wilsden, the curator of education and public programs at the SF MoMA.
Thank you.
Thank you.